Hello and welcome to the 2013 BBC Reith Lectures Download. This year I, Grayson Perry, present a series of four lectures entitled Playing to the Gallery. In these lectures I'll be looking at the role and place of art in the global landscape of the 21st century, talking about topics such as the role of art in society, the limits of contemporary art, and the idea of how we judge quality.
Hello and welcome to Liverpool for the second of this year's BBC Reith Lectures. We're in St George's Hall, one of Britain's finest neoclassical buildings, recently restored to its original splendour. It was designed to hold concerts, festivals and public meetings like this. It's the epitome of Victorian ambition, a great example of its confident taste. Charles Dickens, who loved Liverpool, came here many times and spoke warmly of the city's generous support of the arts. I'm told he gave his first reading of A Christmas Carol right here. I'm not sure what Dickens would have thought about this year's lecturer. I feel certain he would have enjoyed his arguments, even if he was a bit taken aback by the way he dressed, which is why this hall is a good spot in an age very different from the one in which it was built to discuss matters of taste and the nature of art. The lectures are called Playing to the Gallery. The first one discussed how we might judge good and bad art. Today's will explore what the boundaries of art are. Can it really be anything we like, from a pile of sweets to a soundscape? To try to answer that question, and probably a few more too, please welcome the BBC Reith Lecturer 2013, Grayson Perry. Grayson, Dickens would have made a grand job of describing what you're wearing, but as it is, it's up to us. So you go first.
It's very short, in bone satin, with kind of Renaissance-style heraldic motifs of sort of orgies and teddy bears.
And it's got a kind of... It's got a kind of court jester top, hasn't it?
Yes, it's got a little bit of a kind of Italian kind of, what we say, a little bit of the palio, the Siena palio.
The Siena palio. Yeah. And the pop socks and the bare knees.
Yes.
And the bare thigh when the
front few rows are going to enjoy this.
And nice high shoes, as ever. People will wonder, I have to say, why you've dressed up as a woman to deliver the Reith Lectures. I mean, is there an easy answer to that? Are you more confident?
Well, they always say the clothes are best on radio.
This is true. But is she? I mean, because we're talking about what is art. A lot of creativity goes into her, into the frocks and into your makeup. I mean, which should say you've got pink eyebrows and heavy sequined eyelids and so on. I mean, is she a work of art?
No. I use my artistic power to deny that.
Explain that.
Well, I will do in the lecture.
Oh, all right. Well,
dressing up is not a work of art.
Okay, you better deliver the lecture then. It's called Beating the Bounds, and we're about to find out why.
Okay. Okay, it's lovely to be here in Liverpool, because I know that you enjoy your contemporary art, and you probably know quite a lot about it. In my last Reith lecture, I talked about quality and who or how or what ends up in our galleries and how it got there. In this one, I want to talk about what sort of things do and do not qualify as contemporary art. Now, if you ask that question in the art world, there'll be a lot of eye rolling and sort of like, oh God, you know, not that question again. Like, it's been answered. And I think that is often, you know, there's a kind of a complacent idea in the art world that anything can be art now. So it's quite a task that I'm sort of set myself today in what many people regard as kind of the post-historical art world, the post-postmodern, the end of art. We're in a state now where anything goes. But the thing is, I think there are boundaries still about what can and cannot be art. But the limits are softer, they're fuzzier. And I think they're not formal. Anything can be art. I'm quite happy to engage with that intellectual idea. But I think the boundaries are sociological, tribal, philosophical, and maybe even financial. And I've called this talk Beating the Bounds. Now, Beating the Bounds is a ritual that used to go on right back in Anglo-Saxon times, before maps. So when a parish wanted to make sure that everybody knew where the edge of their parish was, that some of the older parishioners who knew them very well would take some of the younger parishioners out, and they would march them round with the priest in a very ceremonial way. And when they reached a kind of major sort of marker stone or something like that, sometimes they would get a whip and they would beat the boys so that they had a strong emotional memory of that exact location. Because that's how we remember things. Taxi drivers have told me that, oh, it's a murder on that corner. And that's how they know that corner. That, because our emotional remembering is very powerful. And so I want this evening to give you a few little stings of the whip, like that, just so that you might remember where the major boundary markers are as we troll around the edge of the art world. But of course, there's a subsidiary question that kind of hangs in the air. And I maybe want you to hold this one in the back of your mind as I'm giving this talk. Why would someone want anything they're doing to be considered art? Because, I mean, there's quite a lot of reasons. The most obvious one is because they're an artist. It's what I do. Maybe they just want a good excuse to do something. You know, there's a lot of, I fancy doing that, let's call it art. And of course, probably one of the strongest reasons why you'd want your activity to be called art is economic. Because there's an awful lot of money, £43 billion last year, sloshing through the art market. So that's quite a nice incentive to call what you do art. Now, going right back, the Greeks, they didn't have a word for fine art as we understand it. And the Romans, they thought sculpture and painting and things like that, they put those in the dishonourable arts because they involved a lot of mess and hard labour, and so they didn't see them as one of the higher arts. And the art historian Hans Belting, he thought that the idea of art we have today, of things we go to see in galleries and that we contemplate as objects, started in about 1400. And this kind of trolled along, and it was refined, and sort of we took it for granted. Oh, yeah, that's art, that's art, that's art. Until modernism came along, late 19th century, mid-19th century, people started questioning, what was art? What's this thing we're doing? And it went through this long transition, this very self-conscious thing, where people, artists, started questioning the nature of art. Until along came Duchamp, who famously posited that anything could be art. But the idea of the traditional still lingers on. If you're on Google Maps and you put in object of interest, art gallery, the symbol that shows you where the art galleries is a little black painter's palette. That idea of what art is still very, even in the 21st century age, is still very pertinent. It's like a child's definition of art. If you ask a child what art is, they'd probably say painting and sculpture, unless they were sort of a North London child, a very smart-ass child that had been to a lot of performance art or something like that. And I'm still very emotionally attached to that whole thing, because, you know, going back to this idea of emotional memory and intellectual memory, I grew up thinking that was art, and all the art I love is quite traditional, and so, you know, even though I can intellectually engage and even appreciate some of the more expanding field of art, I still am more emotionally attached to the old thing. And Marcel Duchamp, the artist, who maybe 100 years or so ago, who decided, you know, that anything could be art when he got a urinal, when he brought it into an art gallery, that was a freak survival. The original urinal that he put into the Independent Art Exhibition in New York in 1917, that was destroyed soon after. It was lucky someone took a blurry photograph of it, and then it was recorded, and it went on to be this incredibly influential and important moment in art history. I find it quite arrogant, that idea that he did, that you just point at something and say, that's art. And it's a very intellectual idea of art somehow. And I would like the opposite power in many ways. I'd love to point at something and say, no, that's no longer art, that there. I'd love that power. I mean, Banksy, the street artist, recently, one of his works that he'd put on the side of a North London Poundland shop of a child worker sewing Union Jacks, that was his contribution to the Jubilee celebrations. The owner of the building very carefully hacked his painting off of the wall and then put it up for auction. And Banksy was very cross about this because this his artwork, he was giving it to the people. And so he said, that's no longer a Banksy. You can't sell it, it's no longer a Banksy. I don't know how effective his negation of its Banksiness would be, but I like the idea. I thought that's a good idea. And I like the idea when artworks are somehow challenged as to their artiness, if you know what I mean. Like a group of schoolboys in 2000, they went into Birmingham City Art Gallery, and there was an exhibition of contemporary art there, and there was a piece by an artist called Graham Fagan, and part of his installation, if you like, was a pile of sweets, and they all just started eating the sweets. And they were sweets, you know. They could. That's their argument. They were sweets. They were lying there. We ate them. You can't deny that. The poet W.H. Auden, he liked heavy blankets when he was in bed. He liked a weighty bed. He wouldn't have liked duvets. And once he was in this house, he didn't have enough blankets on, so he took a painting off the wall, still in the frame, and laid it down on his bed. And I love that idea that he took a painting and made it functional. Another way that art often, I think, stops being art a bit is when it becomes incredibly famous. If you go and see the Mona Lisa, it's like a celebrity. People just want to take their photograph in front of it. I can hardly see it as art. And, of course, the other thing that stops art almost seeming like art is when you just look at it and think, oh, my God, that's worth $250 million. It's just like a great big lump of money on the wall. So this idea that Duchamp... Sorry, I'll just have a drink of water... This idea that Duchamp put forward, that anything can be art, that he decided was art, intellectually, I think, people engaged with it a bit. Not everybody liked it, I can imagine, at the time. But it took quite a long time for people to really kind of get up on that idea and really get going with it. And it was in the 60s when it finally really came to fruition. And artist Robert Rauschenberg, in 1961, he was asked to paint a portrait of a gallerist there called Iris Clert. And in response to this request, he just wrote a little telegram back to the person. He said, "This is a portrait of Iris Clert, if I say so." And that was a work of art. Warhol, one of the most interesting artworks he did was his Brillo boxes. He made some plywood boxes exactly the same size and shape as Brillo boxes, and he stenciled the sides with the pattern of the logo of Brillo, so they looked, all intents and purposes, exactly the same. But they weren't. They were art Brillo boxes, and this was a kind of moment when almost like the whole idea of art kind of collapsed, that the difference between the real Brillo box, supposedly real one, and the art Brillo box, it was like, I can't quite tell the difference. It was very tricky. I mean, ironically, there's a nice little ironic twist sidebar to this story, that the guy who designed the very attractive logo for the Brillo boxes was an abstract expressionist painter. So he kind of played a part in the sort of downfall of his own art movement in many ways. And since the 60s, really, truly, anything has gone. I mean, Piero Manzoni in 61 famously canned his own feces and sold them for the equivalent weight of gold. He also made a piece called The Base of the World, where he got a huge metal plinth in the middle of a field, turned it upside down, therefore rendering the entire globe as his artwork. And since then, artists have used their bodies, other people's bodies, they've walked, they've slept, they've got shot, they've got sunburnt, they've used the landscape, they've done light, they've got film, video, computer code, doing nothing, even pottery has been declared art. So art has become this incredibly baggy idea. When I think of it, the sort of bag that art might be, it's one of those very cheap dustbin liners. You know, the ones that when you drag it out the dustbin and you're walking towards the front door, you're praying that all the rubbish won't spill out all over the whole carpet. That's what kind of art is. It's become this incredibly sort of permeable, translucent, fuzzy bag. Good example for me was when loyalist terrorist Michael Stone in 2006... charged into the Northern Ireland Parliament in Stormont, carrying a viable explosive device. He was luckily arrested and stopped blowing himself up or whatever. But in his trial, one of the excuses he gave was, it was a piece of performance art. I thought, that's a really shocking thing, you know, that art, the shock value of art has become so sort of commonplace that, you know, shocking things, it must be an artwork. This idea that of doing anything you kind of fancy doing and calling it art to sort of lend it kudos or sort of viability has become, you know, quite common. And some Leeds art students in 1998, I think, really parodied this, or I hope it was a parody. But what they did, they got a £1,000 grant for putting on their degree show at the end of their term at art school. And when it came to the exhibition consisted of a series of holiday snaps of them on the Costa del Sol frolicking on the beach, and some holiday souvenirs and the air tickets. And of course there was outrage, and the papers got hold of this, and it was front page news. Art students spend grant on holiday and call it art. And there was, you know, not justifiable outrage. I thought it was very funny. But then the real coup that these students pulled off was that they'd faked it. The money was still in the bank. The tan had come from a salon. The beach they were on was Skegness. The souvenirs had come from the charity shop, and the tickets were fake. I think they brilliantly double-footed everybody's idea that, you know, art is this stupid mucking about, you know, that you can do and just call it art. I think they got a first. Kathleen Moran's husband, Kathleen Moran, the writer and journalist, her husband, when he's doing something that he knows he might fail at massively, like tiling the bathroom or worming the cat, he calls it his art project. This is a worrying trend, because I think it's a wider trend. You know, this kind of amateurism, this kind of mucking about thing, it's all pervading, I think. You know, that often someone who's not very good at making television programs becomes a video artist, or someone who's not particularly good at writing hit songs becomes an art band, you know. And I kind of struggle with my curmudgeonliness here, because I should be all embracing, and the art world should close ranks, and we should all say, yes, everything we do is really brilliant. And in many ways, I am a kind of conceptual artist. I put myself among those, masquerading as a craftsman. And I employ traditional media like pottery and tapestry and etching in a kind of teasing, reactionary way, because I don't want a question in many ways, though writing these speeches has made me incredibly thoughtful about what I do myself. And my personal experience, if you like, of the boundaries of art, I've sort of bumped up, not against the formal boundaries so much, but of a kind of snobbery. Because I think beneath the sophisticated tolerance, yeah, everybody can make art and everything they do can be art, I think there is a little bit of interesting kind of class snobbery going on. Like a urinal, you know, bring that into art, that's really radical. And a shark, bring that into the gallery, oh my God, that's an amazing thing. But a pot, nah, that's craft. But I think what I was encountering, I called my last exhibition The Vanity of Small Differences, which comes from Freud's phrase, which is the narcissism of small difference, where he noticed that the people that a lot of people hated the most were the ones that were almost the same as them. And I think there's a thing about things like pottery and craft, it's too close to art. So they're like the pretentious next-door neighbour that they don't really want to invite round for cheese and wine. I mean, there's this idea that, you know, if you think of contemporary art as a vibrant city centre of culture with all the young, happening, trendy things going on, I mean, you think of the old masters, this beautiful, mellow landscape in the distance. I think sometimes they think of craft as the suburbs, and they drive through it on the way to their second home. So in many ways, I kind of enjoy teasing the art world, and I like to operate on my anti-art power. So somebody said, well, you dressing up, is that art? I go, no, it's definitely not, because I choose it not to be art. And so when I made my TV series for Channel 4 last year, I was talking to a video artist, and she said to me, that telly series you did, that was art, wasn't it? I said, no, it was telly. And I made it with telly values, and I wanted to hit her over the head with my BAFTA. But then you might think, the art world people might be thinking, who are in here, they would say, hey, chillax, Grayson, why the big deal? Why do you really want to kind of put down boundaries about art? Well, I want to know when to put on my art goggles. I want to know when I'm going to look at something as if it's art. I mean, the philosopher George Dickey said, an artwork is a candidate for contemplation or appreciation. So I thought I'd start with my kind of troll round the boundaries of art. And whole books have been written about what art could be. One I found that I kind of found quite interesting, Arthur Danto, a philosopher who writes a lot about art, he said, an artwork is about something, has a point of view, a style, And it uses rhetorical ellipsis, i.e. that it engages the audience to sort of fill in the gap. So it's a sort of call and response. You have to kind of respond to the artwork. And I think one of the most interesting things he said, it needs an art historical context. This is a kind of institutional definition of art. It needs to be in the context where you might find art. But anyway, I thought I would take us all on a handy sort of boundary guide. So I have my whip here to kind of remind you when we come to one of the important little markers as I troll round. And I've got several little tests that I've devised so you might know when you're looking at a work of art and not just at some old rubbish. So the first marker post on my troll round the boundaries is it in a gallery or an art context? Now, Duchamp's urinal, he could have left it plumbed in. But no, he brought it into the gallery. He went to a hardware place and he bought one and he brought it into the gallery and put it on a plinth. Keith Tyson, a winner of the Turner Prize, he did a piece once where he just got the things in the gallery and made them into artworks with what he called his magical activation. So he looked at the light switch and he called it the apocalyptic switch. And he looked at the light bulb and he called it the light bulb of awareness. You know, and so he was using his power, but it was within the art context. And this art context, it can be, you know, quite a powerful thing, but it can also be quite a lame excuse for an artwork. Like if I got the most lovely car in the world, a beautiful vintage Ferrari, that is the most beautiful thing, and I put it into an art gallery and said, this is a work of art now, it would be quite a lame work of art. Be a lovely car, but quite a lame work of art, I think. And often I think there's this happens a lot in the art world, what I call borrowed importance. You can go around an exhibition, you think, oh, I really like the politics, that's right on those politics, that needs saying those things. Rubbish art, though. Well, that's really funny. Rubbish art, though. And so, in a way, the art gallery context thing, you know, is a good test, but it's only a start. My second boundary marker, is it a boring version of something else? I call this one the opera joke phenomenon, okay? Because when you go to the opera, you go for the music and the colour and the costumes and the drama, and get swept up in it. You don't go for the jokes. But of course they have jokes in opera sometimes, and everybody laughs uproariously at these really bad jokes. And sometimes I think that, you know, the things that define something as art is that they're quite boring, that they lack entertainment value, that they lack pleasure. I mean, one of the most insulting words you can call an artwork is decorative. We stand here in this lovely hall here today. I think it's a very noble thing to be decorative. And this idea that art is not pleasurable. Leo Tolstoy said, in order to correctly to define art, it is necessary, first of all, to cease to consider it as a means of pleasure and to consider it as one of the conditions of human life. And I thought, yeah, Leo, you went to a lot of video art, didn't you? Sitting on those uncomfortable benches. I mean, Christian Marclay, a video artist, he made this amazingly clever and brilliant piece called The Clock. It is a masterpiece of video. I recommend it if you ever get to see it. But he did have sofas, which might have contributed to the good reviews. Okay, next boundary marker. Is it made by an artist? Now, my bracelets fell off. Art historian Ernst Gombrich said, there is no such thing as art, only artists. So you have to be an artist to make art. In 1995, Cornelia Parker, conceptual artist, had a show at the Serpentine. Part of the display was a collaboration she did with Oscar-winning actress Tilda Swinton, where Tilda laid in this glass box, and it was called The Maybe, and she was asleep, and you could go along and look up her nostrils and sort of stare very closely at Tilda Swinton. And it was an interesting thing, and it was part of this exhibition. This year, Tilda Swinton decided, I'm going to do it again. And so she put the glass box in the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And, you know, now we're in the age of Instagram and social media. So it's a big hoo-ha, you know. So I find that very interesting that I thought she was the artwork a bit, but maybe she wasn't. But is she an artist? I don't know. Because sleeping in a box, that's quite old-fashioned. Because Chris Burden, the performance artist, he did the bed piece in 1972. And you've got to think that that's an idea that hasn't got many replays in it. Another sort of issue that boils up when we're talking about is it done by an artist is something like Aborigine art. I went to the Australia show recently at the Royal Academy, and there's got quite a lot of Aborigine art in that, and they're very beautiful and powerful objects. But are they art? Because the original Bart paintings were kind of spiritual maps and their relationship with the universe and the landscape and their powerful ethnic items. But are they contemporary art? Are they, you know, they look like abstract expressionist paintings, but are they? You know, because do they know about the contemporary art world? I don't know. But then I read this story about this 81-year-old white artist in Australia called Elizabeth Durack, who painted Aborigine-style paintings under the pseudonym of Eddie Burrup and put them into an Aborigine art show. And there was outrage that she should borrow their special otherness, you know, that the fact that they weren't artists, she was borrowing the power. And yet there was outrage at that, and yet there wasn't outrage about the Aboriginal artist borrowing the power of being a contemporary artist somehow. It's an interesting point about, you know, is it art if it's not done by someone who sort of acknowledged themselves as an artist? Next boundary marker, photography, problematic. Now, in the 1990s, every second show seemed to be photography. But how do you tell if a photo is art? I mean, we live in an age now where photography rains on us like sewage from above. You know, endless Insta snaps on your phone everywhere. So how do you tell if a photo is art? Well, you could sort of go just looking at it. Are they smiling? See, if they're smiling, it's probably not art. I mean, if you look at Thomas Struth, he's a famous art photographer, you know, not many people smiling in his photos. Is there a staginess to them, like portentous? Is there a lot of meaning being emanated out from this image? I asked Martin Parr, the very famous and brilliant photographer, if he could give me a kind of definition. He said, well, a definition of an art photo as opposed to another sort of photo. And almost in jest, he said, well, if it's bigger than 2 meters and it's priced higher than five figures. And I thought, that's actually quite accurate if you think. Because, I mean, say someone like Andreas Gursky, famous, makes these huge photographs, sometimes 4 meters by 2 meters. And his photograph of the Rhine has the highest price of any photograph ever, $4.5 million. Now, this brings us on to an interesting other boundary post, which can be applied to other artworks as well as photography, and that is the limited edition test. You know, because the reason that Gursky's photograph made $4.5 million is an edition of five, and the other four were already in museum collections, so would never be available. And so the only one was left on the private market, and that's why it made such a high price. And that is a kind of example exactly of how the limited edition factor works. So if something is endless, it's giving away part of its qualification as art. And the Tate has a problem with photography, I think, a little bit. Only recently got a curator of photography. I await its curator of pottery. We will find out. Another test that perhaps sounds facetious I have is what I call the handbag and hipster test. Quite often you can't tell if something is a work of art apart from the people that are around looking at it. So there's lots of people with beards and glasses and single-speed bikes, or oligarchs' wives with great big handbags looking a bit perturbed and puzzled by what they're staring at. That's quite a good way, because art is something that is quite, you know, you might say belongs to a sort of privileged people. We've got a good education or a lot of money. And so if those people are kind of staring at it, there's quite a high chance that it's art. And the other thing you might look for is a queue, because people nowadays, they love queuing for art. Especially participatory art, you know, the sort of art that kids can crawl around, or you can take an Instagram of yourself in front of. Need for spectacle, public spectacle. I call that theme park plus Sudoku. You know, people want an outrageous and exciting experience from art, and then they want to slightly puzzle over what it's about. Right, the next test I have here, the next boundary post on our troll around the boundary, is the rubbish dump test. Now, this is one of my tutors at college. He had this one. He said, if you want to test a work of art, he said, throw it onto a rubbish dump. And if people walking by notice that it's there and say, oh, what's that artwork doing on that rubbish dump? It's passed. But of course, many good artworks would fail that, because the rubbish dump itself might be the artwork. John Tingley, in 1960, made a piece called Homage to New York, which was this big metal mechanical sculpture that self-destructed itself into a load of scrap. And many artists have used destruction, so it's not, that's a quite a, not a particularly reliable test, the rubbish dump test, but I do like it. And of course, one thing that we have now in the art world, which has exploded what art can be, and we all have it in our lives, probably the biggest revolution in my life, of course, is computers and the web. And art projects are very easy to do now because everybody can do a little bit of creativity on the web and put their YouTube video up and stuff like this. So I asked somebody, I said, can you give me a definition? And so this test, I'm not sure what to call this test because it might be too rude for Radio 4 if I actually sort of spelled it out to you. But anyway, this test is, let's call this one the computer art test. Okay, now I asked my friend Charlie Gear, professor of media theory and history at Lancaster University. I said, can you give me a definition when I would know that I was looking at a piece of web art and not just an interesting website? And he came up with this. He said, you know it might be art rather than just an interesting website when it has the grip of porn without the possibility of consummation or a happy ending. In other words, it's all about frustrating our urgent need to double-click our way to satisfaction, whether in the form of a joke, an opinion, a fact, a sale, or indeed an onanastic experience. And to detain and suspend us in a state of frustration and ambivalence, and to make us pause and think rather than simply react. And in many ways, it's quite a good definition of any artwork compared to any object. But my tests, you know, they're not watertight, but if you put them all together in a Venn diagram, I bet if the bit in the middle is pretty well guaranteed to be contemporary art. But this pluralism that, you know, we have in the art world, that's a great thing because, you know, you can literally do anything. And I think that is also a problem. I am haunted by this image. After a lecture once, I had a student come up to me and she said, almost whimpering like this, how do you decide what to do your art about? And I was like, oh, I said, well, and I was sort of struggling for, to say something. And I looked at her hand and she had her iPhone. I said, well, I didn't have one of those. Because she has every image, access to all information in her hand. When I started, I had none of that. And I think it's a challenge for young people today. So I hope you've sort of got an idea about the boundaries of contemporary art. They are not formed by what art can be, but where, who, or why. And I hope that my little stings of the whip will help you remember where the edges are when you're next in an art gallery. But the final irony of it is, and I love this story, is that if you go to an art gallery and you see the father of that explosion, Duchamp's urinal, sitting there, it would have been handmade because the original was destroyed. And by the time people became interested in it, you couldn't get that model of urinal anymore. And so those urinals were handmade by a potter. In my next lecture, I will muse on the nature of rebellion and the cutting edge in art. So thank you.
Many thanks indeed, Grace, and it's a tour de force every time. Now let me invite our audience here in St George's Hall, Liverpool, to explore your views on what is and isn't art. Grayson has beaten the bounds, as we've heard. Do you agree or disagree with his definitions?
Thank you, Grayson, for a great lecture. And my name is Charlie Gear. So my question to you is, has art expanded its boundaries so far as to be on the verge of simply disappearing? And if it started in the 15th century, might disappear in the 21st century, or has art a future?
There is a danger that art will just sort of dissipate via the web and all the amazing delivery systems we have now, so that it will just be so woven into ordinary life like a kind of fallout, like art has exploded and the dust is just settled into every single piece of culture. That's why I like the art context definition of art. I want to put my art goggles on and say, this thing, there's a clear, fairly clear place that I can go, a special church, and worship at the great temple of art. So I'm quite attracted to that idea. But I think you're right in that, you know, the web, and I quote you here, I think, in saying that the danger is that it could bring into reality Joseph Beuys, the artist, who said, everybody can be an artist. And you know, we have a zillion one-person television channels with 24-hour access, probably with a viewer of one as well.
That's the thing. I mean, it's all subjective, isn't it, at the end of the day? You put your art goggles on, but they might be completely different from mine or anybody else's.
Yeah, but that's the thing. It's a personal experience, and I think that's what I want to try and empower people, to use that horrid word. When they go, they can say, well, this is my sort of art.
Do you want to come back on that?
Well, I do hope there's a space, because the idea that art being a church is quite attractive, a space of contemplation outside of stuff, so maybe that's what it's for now.
Yeah. Or for onanastic activity, according to
that
your definition.
That too, yeah, absolutely.
I had to go away and look this up. I mean, just in case the audience, the listeners would like to know, it means masturbation. Okay.
That's an interesting segue from masturbation to the Lord Mayor of Liverpool. Thank you.
Oh, there you are, sorry.
Yes, I'm the Lord Mayor of Liverpool, Gary Miller, and also just finished being a member of the Arts Council Northwest. I see you tonight as Claire, and you remind me so much of what my mother thought was art, and that is that she purchased a collected ladro. Would you think that for a lot of people, it's knickknacks that remind them, pottery, ceramics, that reminds them of art at home, which is affordable? Would we see a range of Claire Grayson ladro style?
I did actually once. I was approached by Walt Dalton, I think it was, approached me with, have I got any ideas? And I came up with some rather dystopian collectible figurines.
I would buy it.
But they shied away from them.
I wonder why. Okay, I'm coming to our question at the back.
I'm Janet Holmes and I'm a potter and I live on the Wirral. Do you feel that we're losing skills now and it's only the idea that's important in art?
We might be losing traditional skills, but then other skills are coming along all the time. So, for instance, if you want an equivalent for the Sistine Chapel now, you'd probably look at some digital lab in California, where there's, you know, incredibly skillful programmers and computer animators and games designers that are making, you know, the apogee of 21st century creativity. I can sympathise with those lovely old analogue skills. I don't think we should get overly nostalgic if they become irrelevant.
Well, aren't we going to lose the ability to use our hands?
Well, we may do, yeah, because a lot of those kind of future alien human beings have always got little hands, haven't they? Like that.
I'm coming to my question there, and there was a hand at the back I saw. Yes.
Thank you. My name is James Ayres. There's a quote which was bandied about some time ago, that Picasso said, all children are artists. The problem is keeping them artists. And I always took this to mean that the idea of creativity in what produces the work of art is key. And I'd like to know your feelings on this.
I mean, there's loads of rubbish child artists, I can tell you now. The parents might have their work on the fridge, but you know, not all children are that good at art. But there is a truth in that comment, in that it's about that kind of relaxation and that spontaneity and that freedom. And, of course, one of the great enemies of the contemporary artist is self-consciousness, because in its very DNA is self-consciousness. You are to address the contemporary art world, to work in the contemporary art world, you are achingly aware the entire time of the audience and the history and the value and all the things swooshing about. And so it kills you. It can be very, very... And I can tell you from personal experience that the more successful you become, the more pressure is of self-consciousness, and how I would love to be that little child with a box of Lego bricks again. So he was right in many ways, yes. But of course, you can't be an innocent in the art world. You can't be the child. You have to address the self-consciousness and the art world and the history and the context. You know, like an outsider artist can be a fantastic maker of things, but they never have to deal with what it means to be an artist in the art world. That is the sort of central concern almost of an artist since the 19th century.
I think we're running out of time. Yes.
Hi, Grayson. My name's Linda Jones. I'd just like to ask, do you think it's important to be a good artist, or do you think that you can be a bad artist?
It's important to make art, because the people that get the most out of art are the ones that make it. It's not, you know, there's this idea that you go to a wonderful art gallery and it's good for you and it makes you a better person and it informs your soul. But actually, the person who's getting the most out of any artistic activity is the person who makes it, because they're sort of expressing themselves, enjoying it, and they're in the zone, and they're, you know, it's a nice thing to do. So I don't think it's important to be a good artist, no, unless you really want to be one. I mean, it can be very painful if you aren't.
I'm Laurie Peake, I'm from Liverpool, and simple question, can art be useful?
Can art be useful? What use is art? Well, it's kept me in kind of crisps and beer. I mean, the problem with, you know, art in many ways, it's had its role nibbled away over the centuries. In 1400, you know, when it was in cathedrals and it had this amazing power, it was the call of duty of its day. It was, the all-encompassing cultural experience and overwhelming. And now its role has shrunk, and some people say all that's left is that it's an asset class, or it's a sort of titivation for the middle classes on a Sunday afternoon. I'd like to think it was more, but I think it's central, the role that it used to have as a communicator of the big ideas. I think in some ways it's been eclipsed by all the other media, but it still has a niche left. For me, the niche is that you go and you see the real thing. That is the niche that it still has, because the minute you move away from that, it's something else. Its USP is that there it is in front of me, the real thing that I can see and touch. And I think that is important for me, but I'm old-fashioned. I can appreciate, all the things I've talked about this evening. I can appreciate the intellectual bag that holds all that stuff, but I'm still looking for the thing in the bag.
The thing in the bag, which is contained within the world of contemporary art, about which it seems to me you're pretty ambivalent. You know, you knock it quite hard, you accuse it of snobbery, pretentiousness, and yet at the same time you love it, don't you?
I enjoy the challenge. I mean, I think the one great thing about the art world is that it's up for challenge. And that is what my next lecture's about.
Excellent. There we have to end it. If you want to tweet about this event, please use hashtag Reith, R-E-I-T-H. Next week we'll be in Londonderry when Grace and Perry will look at art and the cutting edge. Is art still capable of shocking us, or have we seen it all before? Until then, thank you to our audience here in St George's Hall, Liverpool, and thank you to our Reith Lecturer 2013, Grace and Perry. Ha ha ha.